Good evening. I would like to do a sound check first. Higher. How is this? Thank you. So good evening again, dear friends. I'd like to celebrate this occasion, the fact that we've gathered together here this evening to hear the Dhamma, to practice. And celebrate the fact that I'm enjoying very much practicing with you, sitting with you on practice meetings, and having the privilege to sit with dear teachers that are teaching on this retreat. And I also enjoyed the cookies that were there today, and I hope you enjoyed them too. He showed me the brightness of the world. A Thai forest monk said about his teacher, Ajahn Lee Dhammadharo, "He showed me the brightness of the world." Because of the famous saying that the Buddha taught, suffering and the end of suffering, we may have a tendency to focus on suffering and on what's difficult. We may think that happiness is somewhere very far away at the end of the path. But the path that the Buddha offers is a path of happiness, of joy, of pleasure, all along. So at this point in the talk, you might already be cringing, because actually, you may not feel like you're going towards more light, because you're struggling or there's some difficulty. So there might be some skepticism about what you're about to hear this evening. So this is just a 1 hour talk, just 1 hour, and I have a sense of an offering. I hope I will be offering something that might be helpful for you. And if not, it's just 1 hour after in your 6 weeks or 3 months. So you can just sit and meditate. There is this fake Dalai Lama quote, which is famous. "There is no path to peace and happiness. Peace and happiness is the path." And the path that the Buddha offered is the Eightfold Path. So what does it mean that this is a path of happiness? The last three factors of the path are right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, right samadhi. And the Buddha presents right effort in four parts. And what is right effort? There is the case where a monk generates desire, a monk here would be a disciple or practitioner, generates desire, endeavors, arouses persistence, upholds and exerts his intent for the sake of non-arising of unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen, for the sake of abandoning of unskillful qualities that have arisen, for the sake of the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and for the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen. This is called right effort. So right effort is presented in these four parts: developing what is skillful and abandoning the unskillful. And they are complementary, they feed each other. When we abandon the skillful qualities, skillful qualities have space to arise. And when we develop skillful qualities, unskillful qualities are naturally abandoned. So, for example, by abandoning aversion, metta arises. By practicing metta, aversion subsides. When I was meditating with Ajahn Suchito, I told him that I was noticing aversion arising in the mind. And he said, "Don't worry. When metta becomes stronger, it will take over. And there will be no more space for aversion." So how does one develop the skillful? By recognizing and discerning. And this is where the other two factors of the path of right mindfulness and right samadhi come together. With right mindfulness, there is discernment of cause and effect. So we understand. We understand what's wholesome, what's skillful. When mindfulness is not present, you may have already noticed here on retreat, when the mind is unguarded, we'll find the minds easily get caught up in unskillful thoughts. And samadhi helps mindfulness. Mindfulness helps right effort. And right effort and mindfulness support samadhi. So I'll invite us to take just a moment right now. Remember an experience of samadhi that we might have experienced today or even right now. We might have a sense of it in the mind and how it feels in the body. So after the inspiring talk last night by Guy, some of you have said, "I want that," and ask me, "How do I practice happiness and calm? How can I make them arise? Can I make them arise?" So this talk is about practicing ways that make those moments of ease and peace and joy more accessible. It's about how to cultivate happiness and peace through celebration. So the whole of the Eightfold Path, there is cultivation and insight, cultivating what is beautiful and understanding cause and effect, cultivation of the seven factors of awakening that Guy spoke about last night, cultivation of the paramis. This is from the Buddha. "Develop what is skillful, monks, practitioners. It is possible to develop what is skillful, because this development of what is skillful is conducive to benefit and pleasure, I say to you, develop what is beautiful, what is skillful. So what is celebration and how does it support cultivation and insight? So celebration is pausing, recognizing, opening to what's here, appreciating and dwelling. Pausing, recognizing, opening to what's here, appreciating and dwelling. Receiving what's already here rather than making something happen. Resting back rather than leaning forward and grasping into the future. Celebration is pausing to appreciate instead of leaning onto the next thing and continuing to run and search somewhere else. Seeing what is already here. If we don't see what's here in the moment, craving is likely to take over, as was exemplified by the excellent question that Guy answered this morning. So celebration is about having a more balanced awareness, wise attention, yoniso manasikara. It's not a denial of what is present. Rather, it's an orientation to include everything, including that which we can celebrate and be happy for. So celebration allows us to take a bigger view and to grow wisdom. And it's also about including what is here relative to what is most skillful at any given time. For example, an eagle has very penetrating vision. When it's flying, it can see miles away, but they will focus on what is helpful, not just anything. So I'd like to go through some of the reasons why the practice of celebration in our path leads to the development of joy and happiness. There are natural rhythms in nature. Celebration is a natural time. It's part of those natural rhythms. And when we pay attention to nature, we begin to notice there's day and night, expansion, integration, advancing and resting. In Africa, there is a very special event, which is actually considered one of the seven natural wonders of the world. And it's the wild beast, or gnu, migration, the great migration. Gnus, wild beasts, are antelopes. And they migrate from the Serengeti Plains in the southeast all the way to Tanzania and Kenya in a huge migration. And each year, at the end of the rainy season, May, June, about 1.5 million gnus migrate together all that way and then all the way back at the start of the rains. And when they migrate, there are many, many dangers. They cross many rivers with many crocodiles. A lot of dangers on the way. Lions and crocodiles and all sorts of dangers. And when they get there, there is rest, waiting for them. There is reward. Another natural event in our lives, which we might be much more in touch with, is that of the breath. The breath is managed by our nervous system naturally, so we don't need to think about it. But we have these natural rhythms of the in-breath, which is more energizing, a heart rate speeds up, and exhaling, where there is a calming and the heart rate is decreasing. I was working with horses for a number of years, and we collaborated together. And they taught me a lot, especially about celebration. Horses generally want to do well, like all of us, we want to do well. So I've learned that if I ask a horse to do something, I would need to let him know that he did well immediately after he did it. Pausing and resting. If I continued to ask, then he would get confused, he would change, do something different. He didn't understand. He thought he was doing something wrong. So celebration has an important role in trust building, in building an alliance with a horse. And in the same way, in our meditation practice, we make efforts, and there is time needed for celebration to develop that confidence, that trust. So nature has a lot to teach in terms of celebrating if we listen. John Croft, an Australian man, after working for many years for ILO, International Labour Organization, in Geneva, and traveling all over the world supporting many projects, community grassroots projects, orienting towards sustainability, he realized that most projects failed. And after studying, he realized that the projects that succeeded included integrated celebration in their project management. So he came up with a methodology that he called Dragon Dreaming, which is formed of four parts. The first part is the dreaming, the motivation, the awareness. The second part, the planning, designing strategies, testing, the implementation, the doing, monitoring, progress. And the fourth one, discerning wisdom, acquiring new skills, transforming, integrating. And in his proposal, this fourth part of celebration would need to get as much time and energy as any of the other four parts. And as a result, to date, thousands and thousands of projects have been using this methodology and have been successful. And there is a famous quote by John Croft: if it's not fun, it's not sustainable. If it's not fun, it's not sustainable. So what does this imply in terms of our meditation? How do we structure our day? How do we conceive of our path? of practice. So more from a scientific point of view, celebrating is a way to change our tendency to focus on what's difficult, on the negative, what's incomplete, what's not going well. And evolutionarily, that tendency has served us well for our survival. It's a survival strategy. There is this famous expression from Rick Hansen, the brain is like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for good ones. So from the scientific point of view, it has been shown that the more an action of mind and body is repeated, the more automatic and spontaneous it becomes. Neurons that fire together wire together. And the Buddha knew this. He said, whatever a monk keeps pursuing with his thinking and pondering, that becomes the inclination of his awareness. So celebration is the opposite. Celebration allows us to focus on what's going well. It's soothing and relaxing the nervous system. Depending on what experience we're going through, it might not be helpful to focus on what's difficult. Orienting to what's enjoyable, easeful, might help us feel more resourced in times of challenge. And that is part of our life as humans. We get confronted with things that can be difficult. And when we don't have the resources to cope, we get overwhelmed. When we feel overwhelmed, we feel hopeless and helpless. And this will manifest as a freeze. So if we experience the freeze in a way that keeps us in freeze, then that's not helpful. We need to ask ourselves, can I cope with this challenge? And if not, our capacity for resourcing is not enough. So in practice, what we can do is to make an intentional pause of attending to what's difficult and direct our attention to what's easeful, orienting to the environment, to nature, bringing in some positive reflections. Boaz Feldman, founder of Neurosystemics, a psychosocial approach to building resilience, says this: we're stepping out of the freeze and we feel more relaxed, feel more resourced. And if we bring in the challenging experience when we're more resourced, then that experience will not be as challenging. We're giving our system the message that we have agency, and that changes everything. That's how we build resilience. So celebration is also an antidote to aversion, greed, and delusion. When we appreciate the good, we're less likely to be caught up in rejection. When we have a sense of fulfillment, of enough, we don't need to look outside to bring in satisfaction. And it's not a denial of the present, but rather an inclusion of everything. So this helps to counter delusion. So can we find other qualities that are present and celebrate them even when fear is present? Aversion is present, or striving is present. I remember when I was meditating on a 3-month retreat at Gaia House And I used to get up very early in the morning, and I went for a walk from 5 to 6 in the morning. I did a 1 hour walk every day. And at that time, it was before sunrise, I would see lots of animals in that long walk. I would see rabbits and foxes, some types of different birds. And one day, as I was walking down those lanes, and if you have been to that area of southwest England, the lanes are very narrow, and they are two-way drives, but only one car fits. So, and the car that fits, it goes on those lanes, touching the sides of the lanes. It's really very narrow. And I was going down one of those lanes, and I saw a mother duck with 10 little ducklings. The cutest thing on earth. And as I was seeing them descending, I was thinking of the cars that might come. And there was no space for that mother duck and those 10 ducklings. So I started to chase them upwards because I thought that would be better. So I chased them, and then after chasing them, I started to go down again. And then I realized when I was down, that they were actually heading towards a stream. And I had just realized I had chased them such a long way up that it would take them a long way to go back to the stream. So I couldn't do anything by that time. They had disappeared, and I returned to Gaia House, and I was feeling heartbroken. There was so much guilt. There was so much pain in my heart. So I went to my teacher, Rob Berbia, and I told him about this, about all the pain that I was feeling. And he said, "Oh, there is so much care. There is so much care for those ducks, for that mother duck and those ducklings." And I hadn't seen that. I hadn't seen all of that care that was present there. So that allowed me to see what else was there. What else is there in the mix? So the need for a pause of celebration has been acknowledged also by great Buddhist masters. This is Shantideva. "The supports when working for the sake of living beings are aspiration, steadfastness, joy, and rest." Joy and rest. And what is enthusiasm? It is finding joy in what is wholesome. The Buddha himself, came to this realization on his quest for full enlightenment. He realized that the work of purifying the heart is much easier when there is a foundation of well-being. So this was a turning point in the Buddha's practice. After having gone through many ascetic practices, and he stopped and tried to think about alternatives. And he remembered a time when he was a little child, and he was sitting under the rose apple tree while his father was working somewhere in the fields. And he remembers this immense peace and joy that he felt in that moment. An experience of deep concentration and pleasure. And when he understood this, the Buddha was able to break through to full enlightenment. And after enlightenment, the Buddha declared himself to be the one who lived in happiness. This is from Anālaya Bhikkhu. Without gladdening the mind when it needs to be gladdened, realization will not be possible. So the question in practice of meditation is, how much joy is present? How much ease? If not enough, then we need to develop more. Celebration is also a condition for right samadhi and right mindfulness. This is Anālaya Bhikkhu. Based on the presence of delight, joy and happiness arise and lead in a causal sequence to concentration and realization. And as we may have already noticed, samadhi doesn't come from focusing and huffing and puffing. It comes about when the conditions come together. And one of the conditions for the arising of samadhi is happiness. As a condition for mindfulness, we'll notice how when there is ease, when something is nicer, we will want to connect. We will want to be present. So there's all these good reasons. And so how do we practice? How do we practice a celebration? So repeating this quote from Bhikkhu Anālaya, without gladdening the mind when it needs to be gladdened, realization will not be possible. So the first practice is the practice of gratitude. We are sitting here because the right conditions came together. So we have the opportunity to appreciate that. To appreciate that there are teachers that can support us. We have a suitable place, warm. We have food. We're being taken care of by the staff, the cooks. There's donors that have made it possible for us to be here. We can also celebrate our fellow yogis sitting here. It will be much harder to keep the schedule without them and to sit on our own. We can celebrate the Buddha, the teachings, and all the people that have been practicing and handing over these teachings down to us. So we can take it as a practice, maybe before each meal we can really take in and appreciate the gift that we're receiving, the nourishment, or before going to bed and really remembering what we've received. So I'd like to propose and invite us to a very short gratitude practice and taking just a few moments to remember one thing that we've received today. One good thing that we feel grateful for today. And really taking it in, feeling it in our heart, feeling it in our body. This is an embodied practice. So, gratitude practice, a way to celebrate what we receive. We can also celebrate nature. I remember once when I was walking and practicing here at IMS on a 3-month retreat, and I was walking in the forest every day. And I remember going back and reporting to Joseph and telling him I was being very mindful in the forest. I was noticing all the sensations in the feet, all the sensations in the legs. I was feeling the body walking in the forest. And then he asked me, "Are you taking it in? Are you appreciating your walk in the forest?" Are you enjoying the nature, taking in the beauty? So there are multiple accounts of the enlightened monks and nuns about the appreciation of nature. This is one from Vanavacha. "The color of blue dark clouds glistening, cooled with the waters of clear flowing streams, covered with ladybugs. Those rocky crags refresh me." Another one from Shitaka. "Peacocks crested, blue, with gorgeous necks, cry out in the Karamvi woods, thrilled by the cold wind. They awaken the sleeper to meditate." This is a poem from Mary Oliver. "I would like to write a poem about the world that has in it nothing fancy. But it seems impossible. Whatever the subject, the morning sun glimmers it. The tulip feels the heat and flaps its petals open and becomes a star. The ants bore into the peony bud, and there is the dark pinprick well of sweetness. As for the stones on the beach, forget it. Each one could be set in gold. So I tried with my eyes shut, but of course the birds were singing. And the aspen trees were shaking the sweetest music out of their leaves. And that was followed by, guess what? A momentous and beautiful silence. As comes to all of us, in little earfuls, if we're not too hurried to hear it. As for spiders, how the dew hangs in their webs, even if they say nothing or seem to say nothing. So fancy is the world, who knows, maybe the stars sing too, and the ants and the peonies and the wormstones, so happy to be where they are, on the beach, instead of being locked up in gold." So we can celebrate also our qualities. The qualities we've been developing here of mindfulness, patience, determination, gentle perseverance, calm, renunciation. The more we celebrate them, the more they grow. And celebrating our qualities is not narcissistic, as we may maybe tend to think. In Western societies, in fact, there may be a shortage of celebration of our qualities. And we may spend a lot of time evaluating what we might want to improve. Maybe we notice a certain resistance as we hear these words of speaking about celebrating our qualities. Maybe some of us think that we don't deserve it, that it feels difficult to value one's own qualities. And that's okay. It's a muscle of happiness and it needs practice. The Buddha himself celebrated his own qualities, and the quality he celebrated the most was that his actions were in accord with his values and in accord with what he teaches. Like Guy said yesterday, the Pali word virya, meaning energy, also means hero or heroine. Can we view ourselves as heroes or heroines? So there is a place for helpful self-view, for recasting our own story, for retelling our narrative. For example, practicing here, coming on retreat, we may not do this just for ourselves. A few years ago, Joanna Macy was giving a course in London, and when she asked people to introduce themselves, she went around and she asked, "Who are you here in the name of? Who are you representing? Who are you here in the name of?" This is from Shantideva. "May I be protector for those without one, a guide for all travelers on the way. May I be a bridge, a boat, and a ship for all wish to cross the water." So the expansion of our intention can bring a lot of joy and happiness to our practice, especially in moments of difficulty. And we can rejoice in our sila too. This is from the Dhammapada. "Here they rejoice, hereafter they rejoice. One who does good rejoices in both places. They rejoice and celebrate, seeing their own pure deeds." I remember a story from Ajahn Jeff, and he was describing one time when one of his teachers, Ajahn Swat Suwacho, was teaching here in the U.S. And he was looking at the meditators walking around the meditation center, and they were all looking very grim to him. And he said, "Oh, the people here in the West seem so sad." That's because they haven't practiced sila. And I don't think he was meaning that people were breaking the precepts or not practicing sila, but more that people were not taking the time to rejoice, to celebrate their own sila that we are all practicing here. Sila really nurtures self-respect, allows calmness to develop, and leads to joy. There is another story from Ajahn Sumedho. In the early times of his practice in Thailand, when he was practicing at Wat Phapong with Ajahn Chah. Once he was having a lot of difficulties with his practice, with his meditation, and he went to Ajahn Chah and he shared his struggle. And Ajahn Chah said, "Reflect on your sila." And Ajahn Sumedho was all worried. What have I done? What have I done? I've done something wrong. Reflect on your sila. And then he realized, Ajahn Chah was telling him to reflect on the sila that he was keeping, the sila that he was developing and practicing, so that he could gladden his mind. And by gladdening the mind, the meditation would go better. And so he did. Gladdening the mind when the mind needs gladdening. So that offers us an opportunity to practice. This is from the Buddha. "If upon reflection we see it was a skillful mental action with happy consequences, then you should stay mentally refreshed and joyful." Mentally refreshed and joyful. We can celebrate also our generosity. I remember when I was practicing in Myanmar in Shaomin Meditation Center, the families would come to make an offering, a meal dana, and they would offering of the whole meal for the whole center, and we would be a few hundreds at sometimes. And I would watch the joy of the people that were making that offering as they would putting the rice in our bowls, in our plates, or handing over the cookie at the dessert table. And there was just so much joy, so much joy. We can also celebrate the absence of the hindrances, and we've spoken about that. Sally has invited us to really take notice when the hindrances are not present. There is a cause, that is a cause for the arising of joy, and there's multiple similes in the suttas that illustrate the freedom that comes when the hindrances are not present. Celebration and seeing the good is also a proximate cause for metta to arise. At the beginning of a metta meditation, we may take a few moments and remember and connect with what is good, in the good qualities of the person we're directing metta to. And also the practice of metta itself is a practice of celebration, focusing on wishes, on good wishes for ourselves and others. The meaning of Brahma Viharas is to dwell, to abide in a divine realm, in divine abiding. One practice in particular that is a very direct path to joy is the practice of mudita. Taking joy in the happiness of others. Sympathetic joy. So I have a friend that made a very long trip just recently. 9 hours train in Europe, going all the way to Turkey. Now 9 hours train first, and 30 hours of a bus ride. all the way from Switzerland to Istanbul. And just the night before that long ride, he had a bicycle accident and was injured and still decided to take that trip and go all the way to Istanbul because it is very meaningful for him to not take the plane and reduce his carbon footprint. So when he arrived in Turkey, he called and he said, "I'm in Turkey." And there was so much joy in his voice. And I was like, "Yuppie!" That really brought a lot of joy, just feeling his joy in that achievement brought me a lot of joy. So there is this quote from Thich Nhat Hanh: "Happiness is available. Please help yourself to it." So we can rejoice. We can rejoice in the happiness that is available. And we can turn to these practices as much as we need. And there is the practice of the jhanas. The Buddha encouraged his disciples to practice the jhanas multiple times in the suttas. He says here, "Bhikkhus, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. This is called the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, that it should be developed, that it should be cultivated, that it should not be feared." So it was with reference to this that it was said, "One should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself." And as we practice samadhi, as we practice the jhanas, we begin to familiarize ourselves with increasingly the refined states of happiness. And we can begin to practice and have these accessible to us in a wider range. Some of these states may, for some reason, have been cut out from our experience. And we may not be used to feeling those. So this practice is also a practice of expanding the range of happiness that can be available for us. And that begins to transform us. That begins to be available in our lives. So as we engage in meditation and in these practices, we realize that there might be some difficulty, some suffering in how we relate to goals. In engaging, we might need to develop a more elastic relationship to goals. So to have goals is helpful and wise. So it's all about our relationship, how we relate. We need to have reflected on this because these experiences will come up. So we need to develop a wise relationship to practice, seeing it as a skill, an art that can be helpful. As I mentioned in the talk, when I spoke about the Zambezi wave, we fall and we get up and we surf and we gain skill in surfing. Having good friends on the path, gladdening the mind when it needs to be gladdened is very important, as we said. And it might be relying on good friends on the path. And I remember a very inspiring story from a guy when he was practicing in Burma under the guidance of Pauk Saedo. He was having a very difficult time. Food was scarce. He was losing weight every day. It was the rains retreat, so it rained every day. Mold was starting to grow on everything that he had. The meditations were very hard. The minimum length of the meditations was 1.5 hours. And some of them was 2 hours. And he had to sit at his spot in the meditation hall. And he had ordained for that time, for that retreat. And he didn't know how to tie his ropes very well. So they kept falling. He had fallen out of habit with keeping ropes. So one day he was feeling very hopeless. And he kneeled on his altar where he had a picture of the Dalai Lama. And he kneeled in supplication. And an answer came immediately to him. The Dalai Lama said, "Stay cheerful, optimistic, and confident. A positive attitude is the best support." End of transmission. That transmission from the good friend Dalai Lama helped him through the 6 weeks, losing so much weight, through all that difficult times and many other times. And it has inspired me to seek friendship. This is a poem from Saint Francis and the Soul by Galway Kino. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within, of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on its brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch. It is lovely. Until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. So celebration leads to the development of joy, of calm, of metta, samadhi. Celebration allows us to bring light to our deepest values, to resource ourselves, and that increases our capacity for compassion. Celebration also leads to the development of wisdom, discerning where to find happiness, what actions of body and mind lead to happiness. As there is more happiness, that releases craving, that releases clinging. With the release of clinging, there is less self. With less self, there is less world. Codependent arising. I'd like to end with a few lines and a poem. The new physics teaches us that the old idea of Newtonian science, of the outside observer having no effect upon what he or she observes, is a myth. We are all participants, and as we can begin to recognize ourselves as temporary nodes in a process of flow, we realize that if the way we look is not part of the solution, then it is part of the problem. Now, I'll read this poem in two languages. The original one is Spanish, and the English, not doing full justice, but La voz a ti de vida, de Pedro Salinas. Tú vives siempre en tus actos. Con la punta de tus dedos pulsas el mundo. Le arrancas auroras, triunfos, colores, alegrías. Es tu música. La vida es lo que tú tocas. De tus ojos, solo de ellos, sale la luz que te guía, los pasos. Andas por lo que ves, nada más. You always live in your actions. With the point of your fingers, you strum the world. You pull out dawns, triumphs, colors, joys. It is your music. Life is what you play. From your eyes, only from them, comes the light that guides your steps. You walk towards what you see, nothing more. Let us sit for a moment. So we have time for some walking and chanting after that.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.